and welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. This week, we'll be talking to Dr. William Davis from Goldsmiths College from the University of London. He'll be talking about his new book, The Limits of Neoliberalism, Authority, Sovereignty, and the Logic of Competition.
So I'm here with Dr. Will Davis from Goldsmiths University of London. We're going to talk a bit about his new book on neoliberalism. Just to start off with, just tell the listeners a bit about who you are, what you do, and how come you ended up writing this book?
So my background is in sociology, but I guess over the years I've become more and more interested in economics and the history of economics and the influence of economics on public policy. Before I did my PhD, which was between 2005 and 2009, I worked in the world of public policy. I worked at the Institute for Public Policy Research for a couple of years. And I was very interested, while I was working in that world, in how it seemed to me that economics had an unusually influential role in terms of justifying public policy decisions. You know, the language of market failure, the language of efficiency, the language of consumer welfare seemed to be at play in how a lot of discussions and arguments about public policy decisions and regulations got made. And whether that's just a merely rhetorical issue, or whether it's a more fundamental issue about how economics actually grasps the world or grasps our imaginations, that's a second question. But on a kind of naive level, I was initially interested in the fact that economics seemed to have this grasp over the policymaking process. At the same time, I was also interested in how the language of national competitiveness, which is still, I think, equally, if not more, powerful today, but the language of national competitiveness...
So this is sort of like GDP?
Not really. I mean, GDP is about macroeconomics and, you know, the aggregate output of the economy and the size of the national economy. What national competitiveness seems to describe, and it's actually a very woolly discourse, but it's a kind of usefully woolly discourse, is how enterprising a culture is, how flexible labour markets are, how attuned to the needs of business policymakers are, to what extent is public spending benefiting the vibrancy of markets or the needs of enterprise or the needs of entrepreneurs, or to what extent is the scientific community or the academic community locked into the needs of the business community. It's quite vague a lot of the time, but again, on a kind of primarily a rhetorical level, I was interested in how talking about the need to compete in the global economy or to compete in the global race, this is a language which today David Cameron is very fond of, seemed to have a certain sort of power within policy discourse. And these were kind of a couple of initial questions that led me to do my PhD, which I did at Goldsmiths now nearly 10 years ago I started it. And I was reading in various areas of economic sociology and what might be called the sociology of economics, which I guess is people like Michel Calon, Marion Foucault, the kind of cultural economy literature, cultural political economy of people like Bob Jessop. I was reading around all of this sort of stuff and trying to frame this problem of sort of firstly, how is it economics seems to have sort of developed this grasp over our policy and political imaginations and discourse, and secondly, why does the language and the logic of competition and competitiveness seem to exert so much power? So that was sort of the background to the research project, the PhD. And then I finished the PhD now nearly 5 years ago, and I kind of carried on reading, particularly in French convention theory of people like Luc Boltanski, but basically developing those same themes, and the book was completed a year ago now.
So the Limits of Neoliberalism, Authority, Sovereignty, and the Logic of Competition, I think is a remarkable book, actually, because it situates itself within a whole range of academic disciplines, some of which you touched on there, but also some very practical political questions. And the first thing that struck me, I mean, this kind of writes at you in the introduction, is the way that it's very upfront about needing to engage with and define neoliberalism in a way that goes beyond just using it as an insult, which I think is how it gets used in many contemporary media and perhaps left-wing discourses of, here are things we don't like, this is neoliberalism. And you sort of touch on neoliberalism, kind of focus on it as, what you call it, the pursuit of the the disenchantment of politics by economics. So could you expand on that?
Yeah. So at its simplest, as I argue in the book, neoliberalism is an attempt, and quite a conscious attempt by some of its more ideological figures, Milton Friedman, in law and economics, people like Richard Posner, people like Gary Becker, that it's an attempt to replace the language of politics with the language of economics. And the question is, why would this be something that was worth pursuing? And I think from the perspective of the neoliberals themselves, economics is a language which has an explicitness and a clarity around it, and it produces numbers. Meanwhile, politics is mired in ambiguity, it is mired in value judgments that can't be defended with reference to evidence. It involves words such as justice, the public interest, society, which don't seem to refer to anything very much. And ultimately, as Milton Friedman says in his famous 1953 essay, The Methodology of Positive Economics, over values, ultimately, men can only fight. And that they have a very, very pessimistic view of what politics is. And as I argue at a later stage in the book, it's partly a view that is indebted to Carl Schmitt, and that politics is has a kind of violent underbelly. And to understand neoliberalism partly on the terms of the neoliberals, it's not something I would take too far, but partly to understand it in terms of what it's trying to do and the forms of justification on which it rests, it is partly an attempt to replace a language which is mired in ambiguity and at risk of descending into violence with a language which is explicit, quantitative, and which almost we can use without having to speak to each other. Actually, and this is not in the book, but I'll just say it while I think about it, because this is, in a way, the person who begins this project is Jeremy Bentham, because Bentham back in the late 18th century says that, you know, that we have to get round the tyranny of sounds, is what he says. That philosophy is mired by the tyranny of sounds, and the advantage of utilitarianism and measuring happiness is that it creates a kind of objectivity about public discourse that otherwise we can't attain. So, you know, and some of these figures in the Chicago School actually voice their debt to Jeremy Bentham in that way. So that's one thing. But I think the other thing is, so that partly about the replacing the language of politics with the language of economics. But I think the second thing to recognise is that neoliberalism is a project that has always harnessed and been enacted by the state. So it is something which both uses the state to push its agenda, but also targets the state for forms of modernising reform. It tries to push economic metrics, economic methodologies into the state, things like new public management, some of the areas that I look at in the book, such as the law and economics movement, the national competitiveness movement. These are attempts to remake the state, but without the kind of seemingly metaphysical language of things like justice, sovereignty, fairness, community identity, this kind of political language. It tries to remake it using language of efficiency, competitiveness, consumer, and so on. But one of the things which I try to stress in the book, and this is not an argument that only I've made, others have made it, Jamie Peck, Michel Foucault in the lectures that were published recently as The Birth of Biopolitics, Philip Mirofsky has stressed this a great deal, but neoliberalism is not about shrinking the state in order to make room for the market. That was classical 19th century Victorian liberalism, which was about, in a sense, pulling the state back in order to open up this space which would be filled by spontaneous, natural market processes. That is classical 19th century liberalism. That is not 20th century neoliberalism. Neoliberalism involves a very active state intervening to produce markets where previously they were absent, intervening in markets to make them conform more to the ideal type of a market. People like Friedrich Hayek believe that the state, using things like antitrust, had to play a very active role in making markets competitive. They wouldn't naturally be competitive. They wouldn't naturally conform to their own ideal. And that a state staffed by lawyers, economists, staffed ideally by neoliberals of some kind, would intervene to construct markets and construct society in ways that conform to a particular neoliberal ideal of how human relations ought to be structured. So again, the state does not shrink, the state does not simply recede, it has a very active role. And in terms of my definition of neoliberalism, to finally come to your question, one of the ways in which I define neoliberalism in the book is that it is the elevation of market-based principles and techniques of valuation to the level of state-endorsed norms. And what I mean by that, you could use an example close to home, something like the research excellence framework in academia. This is something which originates with the state. It enters higher education via public policy, and it tries to get academics and universities to mimic certain norms and principles and techniques of valuation and evaluation in their conduct so that they become market-like. But it does not simply replace universities with the market. And when it tries to do so, often that goes deeply wrong, as we've been seeing in recent months. It's initially a project of remodeling public sector and social institutions in ways that make them more market-like, not simply replacing them with markets.
Yeah, what's really fascinating about this, saying there is the contradiction of the sense of this, and you kind of skip way ahead and sort of come to the conclusion that, you know, neoliberalism has sort of lost the pretense to being liberal and so on, particularly because of the financial crisis and things like that. Point you stress about neoliberalism is not just more markets, but actually it's about constructing and creating and using the power of this really kind of exceptional force in society that is the state. I think one of the things that underpins this is particularly thoughts about how society should function and what would be the kind of most appropriate method or form for doing social relations, which is one of the things you start to explore in the chapter on competition, and the idea of competition being perhaps most appropriate or more best is crucial.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the first point you made, which is how has neoliberalism lost its liberalism? I'll just unpack that a little bit. It's interesting, if you read the early neoliberals, and one of the best books on this, I keep plugging everyone else's work, but Angus Bergin's The Great Persuasion, which is, I think, kind of the fullest history of the development of the neoliberal intellectual movement. But you look, go back to the 1930s, the dawn of neoliberal thought, and the 1940s, and the early meetings of the Mont Pelerin Society, and there was an incredibly moralistic dimension to this intellectual movement back then. The ordo-liberals in Freiburg were neo-Kantians. There were figures who had sort of quasi-socialist belief that what neoliberalism had to do was provide a new type of social settlement, that it couldn't simply throw the welfare state and throw kind of the roots, the core elements of socialism out the window and replace them with kind of capitalism. That what neoliberalism had to do was create a kind of common world, but it would be a common world in which enterprise had played a particular role. And early Hayek, you read The Road to Serfdom, I mean, it's quite clear that what Hayek had in mind was a society which was governed primarily by law, by a common legal framework, by a constitution, albeit a constitution that was very sympathetic to competition and to enterprise and to the price mechanism of the market, but nevertheless, one which first and foremost was one that had a set of rules that included everybody. You know, fast forward to 2014, and we have a society in which elites aren't paying their taxes properly, in which people are moving things offshore if they don't like the rules of a particular society, in which people are fiddling expenses. You know, you have a complete sort of breakdown of any kind of common normative framework. So the question is, how did neoliberalism get from being something which was sort of primarily a sort of a priori normative quasi-Kantian project for the remaking of rights in kind of an economically rational way, to a society which seems to have kind of completely kind of fallen to pieces and become one dominated by the 1%. And I think you have to understand that. You have to look at what happens within the Chicago School over the course of the 1950s and 60s, where they develop this deep scepticism towards the authority of law per se. This is the role. This is why law and economics is so important in my argument. In the hands of people like Ronald Coase, George Stigler, Aaron Director, Richard Posner, Robert Bork, they start to look at law as something which is kind of mired in sort of nonsense. It's too metaphysical. It doesn't have any kind of empirical dimension. You can't measure it. And they start to try and reimagine regulation in ways that is utilitarian, basically. Regulation in which economic evidence is what's key, rather than matters of principle. And once you start to think about law without thinking of it in normative terms and in purely in utilitarian terms, you have lost the kind of a priori basis of law, and you've at the same time lost liberalism. And you have created a situation where you can, if you don't want to be regulated in a certain way, you can pay enough money to a set of economists to construct an economic case for you being regulated in a different way, or you can simply, you know, you can bamboozle credit rating agencies, you can bamboozle regulators, you can ensure that your ex-staff from Goldman Sachs are, you know, taking White House jobs. You have now got a situation where there is no distinction between the law, the regulator and the regulated, because everything is simply a matter of economic evidence and a matter of empirics, and you no longer have that sense of neoliberalism as having any kind of transcendent authority, and it's simply a matter of kind of contingent power games about who can construct the best kind of rhetorical and empirical argument for decisions. So that's my argument, and towards the end of the book I claim that we now live in what might be called contingent neoliberalism, which is a form of neoliberalism which can no longer make claims to being in the common interest in any sense, because it abandoned that notion of liberalism, of treating everybody the same, which you know it had in its roots in the 1930s and 1940s, but gradually cast off as an intellectual movement over the course of the 1950s, 60s, and onward.
There's two things to bring up there, and they're both quite big. First thing you want to take on is the process of this. So, in the book, you talk both about the kind of the political philosophy around this, and you talk about, for example, economics, but also there is a practical story here about a bunch of men, and it is mainly men, who are involved in both academic settings, think tanks, and the governments as well. Could you say a bit about that sort of historical trajectory? Particularly, one of the focuses in the book is the comparison between America and Europe, and how Europe ends up kind of leaping with the United States, particularly in terms of competition policy. In a way that it doesn't seem to have a choice, almost, because it's presented with this, you know, quite rational, quite, you know, seductive story about how to do the modern world that isn't ambivalent and complicated.
There's lots of things in there. I mean, so in terms of who are the agents in this book, which I think is kind of your first question, to research the book, and this is research I did a while ago in terms of the field work I did for my PhD, I went and did a lot of interviews with people who had advised governments, people who worked in think tanks, people who worked in policymaking institutions and regulators, and I guess I was interested in how it is that people can be both social scientists, economists in this case, and also policymakers, how is it that a set of ideas travels around? I mean, this is a huge question, which there are huge literature across various disciplines dedicated to understanding this. But of course, neoliberalism has always, right to its roots, always had a kind of constructivist element to it, whereby, you know, Hayek was always aware that the socialists seemed to have kind of won the argument, at least in the course of the 1930s and 1940s, and the Keynesians seemed to win the argument after that, by virtue of having these kind of these intellectuals. Hayek was very interested in what he called intellectuals. Hayek, intellectuals are people who straddle the worlds of academia and the world of the public sphere, government, business, and so on. So think tanks have always been very important to neoliberalism. In terms of how do the ideas actually move, I mean, you know, there are these key figures. Chicago School, very interesting in terms of, you know, they never actively sought to spread their ideas. They are, I mean, Milton Friedman personally did, but a lot of their most powerful ideas, people like Gary Becker, you know, he sort of sat in Chicago writing papers about human capital and the economics of the family, but didn't kind of actively go out and try and spread these ideas. They sort of found their way into the public domain. Another figure who's quite important in the book is Michael Porter of Harvard Business School, who has done probably more than anybody to propagate the idea of national competitiveness, again, with the help of a think tank, the World Economic Forum, which is famous for the Davos meetings, which happen once a year. But I think one thing which has to be said about neoliberalism as a style of thought is that it's always had that element of American pragmatism of looking for ideas that are useful, ideas that can reduce uncertainty in certain ways, can make the world comprehensible to a certain public. It just so happens that in the case of something like national competitiveness, the public in question is a public of senior business and political elites. So that's the question, in a way, about who are the agents in this. I mean, it's difficult to define them incredibly clearly, but I'm interested in those, in I guess what Hayek called the intellectuals, but these kind of people who sit at the interface of academia and the state and public policy. In terms of how do these then spread and how to spread into Europe, again, I mean, you know, that's a huge historical and empirical question. I don't think I necessarily explain. I don't try and answer that question exactly. I don't think the book... It's probably not one of the books. The book doesn't offer particularly developed explanations of how these things spread. As I say in the book, it's quite descriptive in lots of ways. I mean, I think there would be something to say about... So you mentioned the example of how is it that the European Commission's competition agency imported American ideas about competition. And this is one of the stories that the book tells about how the Chicago School transformed the definition of competition, and then that definition found its way into the regulators of Washington, D.C. It then found its way into the European Commission, you know, 10 or 20 years later. In a way, the European Commission was upsetting a lot of big American firms over the course of the 1990s by trying to break them up and threatening them with antitrust suits. And there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes, a lot of lobbying power. There's a lot of phone calls, no doubt, get made between Washington and Brussels. One of the methodological aspects of the book is that by following the tradition of Luc Boltanski, one of the things that Boltanski does, and which he's been criticised for, is focus very much on public disagreements, the notions that actually a lot of, you know, the critical decisions get made actually quite publicly, and that they don't get made sort of, you know, behind everyone's backs in a way that, you know, a more kind of critical realism would suggest that most of the time we don't really know what's going on. Boltanski says, no, most of the time we do know what's going on. So, and I kind of adopt a similar approach by trying to look at how disputes get made out in public. Now, of course, that has the weakness of not understanding how things actually also get made in secret or get made by virtue of power or by virtue of weight of capital and so on. So I think it's better at, the book is better at tracing how disputes play out in public than it is at really explaining how things then really are going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, because you're quite concerned about having a very specific theoretical framework, which is this French pragmatist tradition. And I mean, you've alluded to it a bit, but I wonder if you could sort of say what that is, why it's useful, and why it's, I guess, different from a lot of other critical approaches, which you yourself are critical of in the book, in the sense of having that idea that unless we tell these stories, unless we kind of look in detail at these public disputes, then we can't actually do transformative social science at all.
So, French pragmatism, very briefly, comes out of Boltanski's distancing from Bourdieu in the early 1980s. And Boltanski was part of the Bourdieu school in the 1970s of critical sociology. Over the course of the 1980s, he developed a new approach with people like Laurent Thévenot primarily, but also Alain de Rosière, the historian of statistics, which tried to challenge Bourdieu's critical sociology and to produce a different basis on which to understand society and understand the role of critique within society. And this is one of the terms that they came up with for this was, instead of doing critical sociology, which looks at how people are dominated in their everyday lives by systems of culture, by systems of power that they can't control and which they don't fully understand, it starts on a different premise, which is that people do understand their circumstances and that they themselves are equipped with critical, political, moral apparatuses, forms of rhetoric, forms of critique, with which they are constantly challenging and constantly able to make sense of the world in which they inhabit, the worlds that they inhabit. And what pragmatist sociology does is try to understand situations on the moral and critical terms of those who inhabit them. So trying to, in a way that is, I guess, sort of not that different from someone from a sort of Goffman-esque, kind of Irving Goffman-esque sort of frame analysis or an interpretation of the performances of everyday life. Trying to understand how people can agree on what's going on. And the way they agree on what's going on is that they have a common agreement about what is of value, what matters in a situation. And then every now and then they will have a conflict as to what matters in a given situation, and they will have some kind of dispute. And what pragmatist sociology, otherwise known as convention theory, otherwise known as the sociology of critique, tries to do is to understand the worlds of people in their everyday lives in terms of these disputes. Now, there are certain people whose notion of what is valuable or whose notion of what is going on will have certain greater influence than others. So if you work in a statistical office, or you work in a government regulator, or you work in a situation where you are marking students, a large number of students, and you're trying to work out who is the best student, obviously your notion of what is valuable and what is less valuable will have far greater reach than someone who is, than the student themselves. The student can still challenge that grade, but there will be ways in which the person whose valuation systems and methodologies within, in that example, the person doing the marking will be able to sort of construct the world and shape how the world holds together in the way the language they like to use. How does the world will hold together in a way that is more informed by someone who works in, say, a statistics office or is doing the marking of the students than someone on the street. But one of the things that Boltanski and his collaborators try to stress is that everybody is equipped with critical apparatuses. It's not simply sort of sociologists themselves who can go around and criticise the world. So now some people have said, well, this is just caving into to kind of neoliberalism. It becomes a kind of naive credence in whatever people have to say about things. And it, you know, in a sense, it developed concurrently with Latourian action network theory and has certain kind of commonalities with it in seeking to challenge critical realism and so on. So that's a kind of sort of very potted summary of that. In terms of why did I want to take this approach? Well, I guess one reason is a pessimistic reason, which is that it seems to me, and I kind of developed this a bit in the first chapter of the book, is that it seems to me that it's no good to simply say, oh, you know, it's all about class, or it's all about, you know, we need to be more social, or we need to you know, appeal to democracy or something. Because a lot of these terms, and again, no doubt some people would criticise the book for simply sort of keeling over and sort of accepting defeat, but it seems to me that the language of the public, the language of class, the language of society has lost its performative power to make this world in certain ways. And I think that that has to be understood partly as a deliberate political project on the part of certain people. I mean, I focus a lot on Friedrich Hayek. Hayek quite explicitly sought to try and, you know, he was very, very critical of the language of socialism, of social democracy, and that there is a deliberate project of replacing concepts and moral frameworks which view everyone as equal, and trying to replace them with concepts and moral frameworks of competition, which actually are ways of showing how people are unequal. And in a sense, one of the things which I try to stress in the book is that inequality isn't something that's just sort of arisen as a virtue of, you know, globalization or capitalism or class or something. Inequality is something which is produced by the fact that we have flooded our society and flooded our education system and our public institutions with metrics which are designed specifically to show how certain people have greater worth than other people. And if we want to challenge inequality, we can't simply kind of, you know, challenge these kind of abstract forces such as globalization or capitalism or, you know, to some extent, even neoliberalism. We have to actually look at the metrics and the measures which go around and say this person is worth twice as much as this person. So in that respect, I think the sociology of critique, the pragmatist sociology, does have useful political power because it alerts us to the fact that things have been performed rhetorically and politically in certain places by certain actors in certain at certain times in certain places. And it hasn't simply just come about by virtue of sort of macro political kind of gaseous sociological forces. So in a way, the book is saying, let's stop doing sociology for a second and let's see what happens if we follow the actors a bit, which is, you know, to use the Latourian term, and follow the discourses and follow the rhetorical motifs and some of the kind of the moral motifs, because these are latently moral notions of agency, of things like entrepreneurship, of things like consumer rationality. Let's follow these different concepts, see where they come from, and then say, well, this is why the world is as it is. The world didn't simply magically become like this. It went on, a lot of it went on under our noses, but we weren't looking closely enough at the way in which the world was being constructed by people who claimed that they were doing so purely on the basis of evidence, on the basis of technocratic objectivity. But actually, one of the things that convention theory does very well is to problematize notions of objectivity, to problematize the notion that the social sciences are ever free of things like moral and political philosophy. Because actually, whenever we do economics or social science, we are implicitly drawing on latently moral notions of what a human being is, of what agency is, and so on. And that this is how, you know, the world has been run for several decades.
Just picking up on that sort of sense, this is how the world's been run for several decades, and coming back to this critical moment. Towards the end of the book, you really address the curious situation we found ourselves in the great financial crisis in 2008. Seemed to be this direct challenge to that neoliberal way of doing things, and yet kind of trundles on. It's like the emperor's been called naked, but he still walks down the streets, as it were. And so you talk about these two approaches to kind of defend neoliberalism. One is what you call a neo-communitarian term, and the other is just the sheer force and power of executive decisions taken by the state. So as a way of kind of concluding the discussion about the book, could you just say what those sort of mechanisms of defense are, and maybe what we can do to challenge that?
So, I mean, as you say, there were a couple of... In the final chapter of the book, which is called Contingent Neoliberalism, I identify a couple of ways in which neoliberalism has a kind of what you might call an anti-critical mode. If we think of critique, and again, this goes back to convention theory, but if you think of critique as, you know, the core meaning of critique is judgment. It is the notion of critique, the notion of crisis. These are... the question is of critique is how do you resolve uncertainty and how do you renew things? How do you set things on a new path through resolving their uncertainty? And one of the things I argue is that what neoliberalism has done very well is to develop an anti-critical strand. It's very successfully made it difficult or sometimes impossible for the system itself to be subjected to judgment or critique. And the two of these are, one is what I call neo-communitarianism, which is an attempt to try and focus upon the kind of psychological dimensions of consumer rationality, which is things like behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, happiness economics, to try and to perpetuate neoliberal behavior, turn neoliberalism into a problem of behavior, which is that if people are no longer acting as economists predict or assume, focus on reorienting their behavior so that the model becomes perpetuated. So the behavioral turn, I think, is very interesting in its own right. The second is what I call market exceptionalism, which is where effectively the state looks at markets which are no longer viable, financial markets primarily, and does whatever it takes to prop them up. So obviously the bailout of the banks, quantitative easing, making economists unelected prime ministers of Italy and Greece, these things which basically say, no matter what happens, we will perpetuate this model at all costs. We will not allow the moment of crisis, the moment of critique, the moment of judgment to arise, because we will perpetuate this model at all costs. Of course, in the process, if you say we're no longer going to allow for judgment, you also have a model which cannot be legitimate, because it's only judgment or critique or crisis which could allow for this model to be legitimate. Because if you are not prepared to face a public or face a judge, you cannot then expect to be legitimate. You will simply be, as I say, contingent, only propped up by force of power, by force of executive diktat, and so on. Now, in terms of alternatives, I think one of the problems is that our language has been so permeated by economics, our political language, that it's quite difficult to simply say, oh, well, we need to sort of, you know, return to social democracy, or we need to sort of, you know, I mean, I think there are, you know, we could talk about policy things about nationalising the banks and then running them differently, but I think this is quite what's so relevant right now. One of the things which I think is interesting to do, and this isn't, again, this might sound like defeatism, but I think it's an interesting critical avenue to go down, is to think about how might you do neoliberalism differently? Because in a sense, what neoliberals recognised right back in the 1930s is that how the economy is governed is a, you know, in a sense, they collapse politics and economics together. They then say, right, what kind of, how do we want to govern the economy in a way that certain types of political virtues are upheld, which, you know, tend to be conservative political virtues of self-reliance, enterprise, competition, and so on. But I think one of the things which I throw out at the afterword of the book is, imagine if you were going to start neoliberalism again right now, but to do so on a different set of values, could you imagine lawyers, because the lawyers were very important to the early neoliberal movement, could you imagine a situation where lawyers were constructing economic institutions and constructing regulation on a different set of values than those of corporate capitalism, which is in many ways exactly what the early neoliberals of the 1930s, the ordo-liberals, were trying to do. So you think of someone like, you know, Lawrence Lessig, who founded the Creative Commons movement. He was a lawyer who understood that the economy is constructed by documents, by sovereignty, by rules, but that you can do those things differently. I'm interested in cooperatives and employee-owned companies. Now, one of the reasons why there aren't more cooperatives and employee-owned companies in the world is because regulators make life very difficult for them. The law is not constructed around their interests. They find it very difficult to describe what they do to auditors, to regulators. They're constantly, worried about looking corrupt because they aren't able to communicate their activities in ways that mesh with the regulatory framework of nation-states. But again, I think only a small band of lawyers could make a huge difference to the way in which capitalism was constituted if you had contracts which were written differently, regulations which were written differently. And the other area, which again, thinking about what was important to the neoliberals, but how would you subvert it, is entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is, as we always had this kind of heroic, conservative, romantic, quite Nietzschean idea of what an entrepreneur is. Schumpeter really encouraged this in his work as someone who kind of imposes their sort of exceptional, disruptive ego upon everybody else, and everybody else just kind of follows them. You know, it's the sort of Steve Jobs idea of the entrepreneur. Well, how would you build a notion of entrepreneurship on a different sort of political philosophy? For instance, a sort of a more of a democratic political philosophy. How would you take, say, the political philosophy of Hannah Arendt and develop that into a theory of entrepreneurship, such that you had, you know, people congregating to create companies but not a single exceptional individual, which has always been a very bad description of capitalism as it actually works anyway, because after all, the way corporations work has very little in common with the idea of a heroic entrepreneur. Of course, it works very well for their CEOs and their executives and the way they pay themselves, but But I think, in a way, if you want to reinvent capitalism, you have to take some of the core elements and then think about how you can define them differently on the basis of different political philosophies and different moral philosophies, and then develop those political moral philosophies towards different valuation systems, different metrics, different tools, and different legal frameworks, and not simply wait for the state to come along and return us to some golden age of Keynesian social democracy, because frankly, I can't see that happening, not least because the state has been more as permeated by a kind of a narrowly economic rationality as anyone else. So I think it's up to us as academics, it's up to activists, it's up to lawyers, it's up to entrepreneurs themselves to think about how to build different types of economic institutions which directly challenge and falsify neoliberal assumptions about the nature of human agency and the nature of economic agency.
It's really interesting and quite a good sort of hopeful note to conclude on. In the short term, you've got a launch event for the book here in London.
Yeah, on the 10th of June at Goldsmiths.
And then what's your sort of next big project?
Well, I'm actually just finishing another book at the moment. So there'll be enough projects for quite a while, but which is on the history of Benthamite happiness measurements, which will be out kind of this time next year, which is a sort of history, again, similar sort of approach of looking at how we are today in terms of the different elements. So it looks at Jevons and the early neoclassical economists. It looks at the early behaviorists such as Watson. It looks at, again, it returns to some of the Chicago school a bit. It looks at Bentham, it looks at people like Gustav Fechner, but it looks, you know, so trying to think about why is it that we think that there is a part of us as human beings that kind of fluctuates up and down in kind of a quantitative fashion that we refer to as either happiness or well-being, and that once that we can kind of know it, either through sort of brain scans or through surveys or through kind of Twitter sentiment analysis, that if only we can know this thing that fluctuates, then we can kind of be perfectly attuned to the rest of the economy in some way. So I'm doing that. But then I'm also setting up this new research centre at Goldsmiths, which will be a centre of cultural and political economy. And will, I think, hopefully, kind of for me personally, but for lots of fascinating work going on by colleagues at Goldsmiths, sort of bring some fresh perspectives on economic issues, drawing on anthropology, cultural studies, political science, sociology, and trying to kind of break the kind of stranglehold that orthodox economics has upon our economic imaginations and political imaginations.
Well, great. Good luck with that. I look forward to seeing the results. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien from City University London. We've been talking with Dr. William Davis from Goldsmiths, the University of London. We've been talking about his new book, The Limits of Neoliberalism, Authority, Sovereignty, and the Logic of Competition, which is out now. Thanks for listening.